Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome and hello. This is Joseph G. with Rum Radio and rumradio.org. It's the most comprehensive 12-step sponsorship in the known and the unknown universe. The unknown universe, that's always kind of interesting. I do it as sort of like a tongue-in-cheek announcement. But there is a world of spirit that I understand is amongst us. We just don't see it. I'd like to acknowledge WNAH, Hoyt Carter, and Tony the Horse, who affords us the opportunity to broadcast live to their listening audience in Nashville, parts of Kentucky, and Alabama as a public service presentation. It's Tony the Horse because Tony is the sole salesperson at WNAH. He carries the load, and Hoyt is the station. Quite the two peas in a pod out there. They've been there since 1949. Hoyt hasn't taken a day off in 8 or 9 years. To each his own. That's what makes the world go round. We also like to acknowledge RecoveryToday.net magazine. It's one of the finer recovery journals, and they afford us some print space from time to time. As a matter of fact, I need to give them a holler. I gave them two pieces lately. Some of the best Christians ever met were atheists, and meditation, an attempt at thinking not to think. So I'm going to see if they're going to print that for me. It's a way of getting out the word on rumradio.org. This is the intention of the radio show also, is to put the website into a audio format for the folks that might not even be able to read or prefer listening to it, and an MP3. That's the deal. Rum Radio is the hub of this thing. It's about sponsorship, things that we don't usually talk about in 12-step recovery and in meetings. Usually we have workshops that go along, but they're usually few and far between. Most of the sponsorship is done in 12-step programs. Your sponsor sponsored you the way his sponsor sponsored him, the way his sponsor sponsored him, et cetera, infinitum. And I considered that as the telephone. In high school, or not even high school, actually in elementary school, you play a thing called telephone, where you go around a circle and you pass on a statement using the verbal tradition. And by the time it gets around the circle, one thing you could be know for sure, it's not going to look like anything like it started out. Something will be added, something will be lost, and definitely something will be changed. So I thought, gee, you know, maybe it might be a great idea to actually have written information. Now, you don't have to use it all. You don't have to use any of it. But they're tools of understanding from experience. 12 steps and 12 traditions of AA is an understanding of practical experience by using the basic text of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now that I mention that, we are not affiliated with AA. This is Rum Radio and rumradio.org. We use the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous because that is the primer, the template of all 12-step programs. That's the mother of all recovery. The 12 steps and the variations derived therefrom, this is the original. So anytime you duplicate the original, you're usually going to get a copy. The copy is really, I found, never to be as crisp, accurate, or important spiritually, I think, as well as emotionally as to any original, but that's my point of view. I gratefully like to introduce my co-host, Harold B., a family intervention specialist. He does a fine work with troubled families, and I personally believe that families are the basic unit of our society. And as the family goes, so does the nation. Harold.
Hello, everybody. Thank you, Joseph, for that nice introduction. And I really enjoy being here. This is my way of giving back, one of the ways I give back. I owe my life to the program, the 12 steps, the people in the rooms of AA who loved me until I could love myself. And so Joseph and I are really dedicated to going back to basics. The way this thing was done back in 1935 was very effective, and the big book grew out of that. And there's so we're the whole thing started because Bill Wilson found that he couldn't do it by himself. He needed to talk to another alcoholic. He found Dr. Bob, and with the two of them talking, they each benefited from their conversations, and so they went out together and found another guy in the hospital, talked to him, and then they found more and more people. And by working with people that are newer in recovery, it solidified and strengthened each person's recovery. And that's how this thing works. Somehow along the way, it seems to me that some of that energy has been lost. I think people enjoy their comfort a little too much. It's a little bit uncomfortable to get up off the couch and get out the door and go work with another alcoholic, with somebody that has addiction, somebody that's newer to recovery than you, somebody that might need help. And it says in the big book, work with their families. And so that has really been the main principle that's kept me sober. And everywhere I go, I attend meetings, and I am dedicated to the principle that really worked for me. And because I feel like I have an obligation, a duty to expand that and continue giving that the way it was given to me. If people had not done it right for me, I wouldn't be here. So we have a duty and a responsibility to go back to basics and do it right and not fall for this thing, the suggestion, and I think it comes from the enemy, that states that being clean and sober is enough, that's all we've got to do, attend meetings, keep coming back. Those things weren't said in 1935. This was about going out, finding people. You don't sit back and wait till they come to you. So that's what this website is about. And let me mention briefly that this website exists because Joseph G. has started it at his own expense. He's improved it at his own expense. He doesn't make a dime from it. It's not a commercial site. It's a public service. The radio broadcast is a public service. And he really deserves a pat on the back. And the whole thing is, when we survive this deadly disease, this progressive deadly disease, and we find our way back to our connection with God, because addiction is a search for God at the wrong address. And this is a spiritual program. As we find our recovery from addiction and we get back to our conscious contact with God, the whole thing adds up to the fact that we find heaven that way, by being humble, by having faith in God, and by letting that faith be strong enough to turn our lives around. The 12-step program is a new way of living, so this affects our eternal life. This is a spiritual war. The enemy doesn't want us to recover. God wants us to have a conscious contact with Him. That's what this is all about. Now, I've been studying and working the steps and working with new people for over 24 years. At first, I didn't comprehend the spiritual aspect of it, so I don't want to chase anyone that's new away, but you do deserve a heads up that when you get into recovery, that's not just quitting alcohol is not the end of all this. In my opinion, Alcoholics Anonymous exists to help people stay quit. It's fairly easy to quit. What we want to do is stay stopped, and that's what the 12 steps are for, and that's why we work with other people. So this is Back to Basics, and this has all been done as a public service, and I appreciate Joseph for that. And so let's begin the program in our usual way, Joseph.
Thank you, Harold, and I always appreciate your acknowledgement. It's very humbling, and like usual, if that's enough about me, would someone else like to talk about me? I'd like to start the program with the third step prayer. It's found in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous on page 63. It's kind of like we start in the program in the meetings. We have a prayer to start our meetings, and a prayer before a meeting is usually have a name. It's called an invocation. It means inviting in the spirit. And, of course, at the end, don't do it, maybe we can consider it. After a meeting in recovery, usually there's another chant of some kind, and that usually when you close it with that kind of prayer or understanding, it's called a benediction, which is a form of gratitude that the spirit was among you. So I like to start with that. Third step prayer, also called a surrender prayer. There's several other ones I just came across today. I put them on the website. Clarence. Had a third step prayer, and let's see and Dr. Bob had a third step prayer. Did you know that, Harold? Clarence Snyder?
No, I didn't.
Yeah, Clarence Snyder. Yeah, Clarence. It's on the website. It's under the Big Book Index, Prayer Index, the Big Book Prayer Index. It's on the captain's table. So I added that to the third step prayer. Dr. Bob's third step prayer and Clarence Snyder's third step prayer. Clarence Snyder was early on, he was the founder of the third group in AA in Akron. And Clarence would say he really was the founder of AA. But he was an alcoholic for sure, trying to get that spotlight. Dick B. had written quite a bit about him.
All right.
Okay, anyway, so what I do with the third step prayer is that when a newcomer comes in and I'm looking for a sponsee, page 89 says, find a prospect and start working on him. So I'm real explicit about that. It doesn't say have the prospect find you. That's what it says on page 89. Find a prospect and start working on him. Clear cut direction. And I go find the prospect, and he's gotten his beginner's chip. I find that to be a good time to work on him. They're coming through the doors. I'll start with this. I can go to Skid Row. That I already know. And like Bob and Bill, I can go to the hospital. Now I hear tell they come in under their own steam, washed but not clean, and desperate for simple instruction. The next time this golden opportunity walks through the doors, I will push and shove and help them find their seat so my own recovery becomes complete. They're coming through. You know, we don't have to get them as much as we used to anymore. Some still do, but right now they're coming through the doors. So I got him after he gets his beginner's chip. Hopefully he announced that he's an alcoholic, recognize the problem, and by doing that, he's conceded to his innermost self that he has a problem. Until there's a problem, there's no solution to be found. He's acknowledged the problem, he's identified with the group, and I go on the prayer, I grab his hand, and right after the prayer, I ask him, have you had enough? Yes or no? They ask what he means. Usually if they've had enough, they know exactly when I say, have you had enough? They know exactly what that means. But if not, I say, have you had enough pain? Have you had enough sorrow? Have you had enough humiliation? Have you had enough alcohol? Have you had enough? Yes. Okay. Next question. Are you willing to go to any length to achieve sobriety? Yes or no? Nobody ever asked what that means. That's too straightforward. Yes. Okay, we're still in the game. You can get, I tell them, you can get well from this disease of mind, body, and spirit. But there's certain things you have to do. And the first thing I ask to do is I carry around with me Clancy's 7 questions, really interesting questions. It gives them a format. It's not to replace the fourth step. But the question is, I don't really care that much what they say, that they answer the questions, but the next direction is critical. I need you to answer these questions. First thing I need you to do is answer these questions, and I need them back tomorrow. Here's my number. Expect your call. You know, and then I'm done with him unless he takes the next step. I did my deal. I presented it. I gave him the idea. I gave him simple instruction. If he does, he follows through. He's interested. If I don't hear back from him, I'm not concerned. I would like him to be ready, but he's not ready. It's not my job. That's between him and God. If he's ready, he'll do the work and he'll call. If he's not ready, he won't. And two things, either he's not ready or he's not ready for me, and that's okay in any event. And then one of the first assignments I give him is to recite the third step prayer to his home group. To get a home group, which is sort of like your contemporaries in a particular geographical location, usually closer to your home, where you're going to regularly attend your meetings. Still important to go to meetings. That's where the fellowship is. But remember, that's the fellowship. That's not the recovery. Recovery is in the steps, the 12 steps, not in the meeting. Now, you get the name of 20 or 30 people, possibly men, boys with boys, girls for girls. It's not romance. This is about life and death. Now, if you can't get the like gender, the key is you still work the steps, and then we do the best we can. It's a very intimate relationship when we work the steps, so we try to keep that at and it's easier to relate to the same gender also. So there's no inappropriate intimacy. And then every day for the next 30 days, I want you to call one fellow on the line every day, different fellow every day. Try to get a hold of him, do the best you can, and ask if he got permission to recite the third step prayer to him. And the reason I do that and I explain that is that it gets him used to picking up the 500-pound telephone and asking for help. Two, it connects them up with the home group. They get to know his name, and he gets to know their name. Three, this encapsulates what we're going to try to accomplish by working all 12 steps. And fourth, the person he's calling might have been thinking about picking up his first drink of alcohol, and chances are he will not. No guarantee, but your sponsee is already in service. And this is the third step prayer. It's also called a surrender prayer. God, I offer myself to thee, to build with me and do with me as thy wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help, of thy power, thy love, the way of life. May I do thy will always. Can I get an amen on that?
Amen.
What I had discovered, this is kind of a little side venue here. I did the prayer index. It's on the Rum Radio under the prayer, Big Book Prayer Index. And, you know, there's really no fourth step prayer. So I made one up.
Good.
God, please let me forego walking the fish and waxing the cat, cleaning my room and doing all that other crap, and put pen to paper and give me the will to relive my sordid past. Please give me the strength to look in the mirror and view all my pimples, warts, and cracks. Give me the courage to unburden my soul and get back on track. And let's not forget, thank you for being the God of second chances. Amen.
Wow, I like that. Amen.
You like that?
Thank you.
A little tongue-in-cheek there, but I think it kind of lays it right on the line, doesn't it?
It does.
Most of the time with the fourth step is a very critical step in the program. This is the time that we really take some work. I believe you can do the first three steps sitting in a traffic light. But the fourth step is really where the rubber meets the road. The true intent of the program.
You mentioned
the fourth and the fifth
in there.
Yeah, the fourth and the fifth step, I think they go together. The first step is the problem, whatever the addiction is, alcohol with Alcoholics Anonymous, coke with whatever it is just step one. Steps two and three hang together. Four and five, six and seven, eight and nine, 10 and 11, and then 12 hangs alone again. So they're really A, B steps. One is it develops a willingness, and the next step, execution. Willingness, execution, usually, right? Harold?
Yeah, that's nicely put. First we become willing. And for me, for example, step six and seven, I always wondered why step six was in there. I mean, it states, became entirely ready to have God remove our defects of character. Well, goodness gracious, defects of character. Why wouldn't each of us be automatically entirely ready? And one of my sponsors, not so gently put it, that I wasn't finished using some of them yet. And, for example, especially self-pity. If I'm having a pity party every other day, I'm not entirely ready for God to remove that, and He won't. I'm still using it, thank you very much. So, yes, it's a willingness and then an execution, and working these steps brings a new way of living, and it requires that we turn from the things that were creating so many problems for us, the things that, in my way of putting it, is things that open the door for the enemy. And so, yes, willingness and execution. Joseph?
Yeah, thank you, Harold. Once they get started, nothing will ensure immunity from alcohol intensive work with another alcoholic, and this is what it's all really all about. There's more to it. The big book also tells us that we think a man in thinking who says sobriety is enough. That would be odd. It means that there's more, much more causes and conditions, and that alcohol was a symptom of the disease.
Yes.
We have to get down.
Selfishness and self-centeredness are the root of our problem. Alcohol is but a symptom.
Well, good. There's something else, but I lost the train. So we're going to get right into we're going to try to two segments on the captain's table tonight. The captain's table is a part of the big book, too. It's we're like passengers in a great ocean liner that has been rescued from a disaster, and then there's joy and camaraderie and democracy from steerage to the captain's table. Rum Radio on the outside, a little deal, we have like a beach, Sobriety Beach. This is sort of the place you come to from the shipwreck. This is the first landing from the shipwreck. You can see the desert island is our format. Tonight we're going to be doing one of them is one of the segments is John Barleycorn Must Die. John Barleycorn's mentioned in the big book. And the first time I heard it, I didn't know what they meant by John Barleycorn. Did you know, Harold, when they said John Barleycorn?
Oh, yeah, I just turned 65, so that's part of the vocabulary of my era and my dad's.
Well, I wasn't sure what that was, and what I knew, the song from Traffic was a rock and roll group from 1970, and they did a song. They recorded a song, was made popular. They made this song popular again. It's a 13th century tongue-in-cheek dirge of the futility of trying to kill King Alcohol. Now, of course, tongue-in-cheek means this is sort of facetious, humorous to some extent, and a dirge is a song that you would sing at a funeral. It's a funeral dirge. So it's about the death of John Barleycorn. So, and the name of the song is John Barleycorn Must Die. Two of the main ingredients of alcohol is barley and corn, whiskey. There were three men came out of the West. Their fortunes for to try. And these three men made a solemn vow. John Barleycorn must die. They've plowed, they've sown, they've harrowed him and threw clods upon his head. If you're a farmer, you know exactly what they're talking about. They're plowing the field and then covering him up. They sown the seeds, they harrowed him. In other words, they hoed him into the, and the clods went on his head. And these three men made a solemn vow. John Barleycorn was dead. They've let him lie for a very long time, till the rains from the heaven did fall, and little Sir John sprung up his head, and so amazed them all. First buds, they've let him stand till midsummer's day, till he looked both pale and wan, and little Sir John grown a long, long beard, and so became a man. They've hired men with scythes so sharp to cut him off at the knee. They've rolled him and tied him by the waist, serving him most barbarously. They've hired men with sharp pitchforks who pricked him to the heart. And the loader, he has served him worse than that, for he bound him to the cart. They wheeled him round and round the field till they came up into a barn. And there they made a solemn oath on poor John Barleycorn. They hired men with crab tree sticks to cut him skin from bone. And the miller, he served him worse than that, for he ground him between two stones. And little Sir John in the nut brown bowl. And the brandy in the glass. And little Sir John in the nut brown bowl proved the strongest man at last. For the huntsman, he can't hunt the fox, nor so loudly blow his horn. And the tinker, he can't damn kettle nor pot without a little barley corn. Harold?
Wow, there was a shorter version my sponsor used to talk about. He said that while we're in the meeting, our alcoholism is out in the parking lot doing push-ups, getting stronger. This disease is, there is no cure. It's progressive, and it's fatal if we don't make it go into remission.
Ah.
We can keep it in remission, but it doesn't go away.
That's always been a big argument with a lot of folks. People who say that usually are not that a familiar or aware with the concept. To them, alcoholism is willpower, that you don't have enough won't power. you know, he's such a nice man. You would think for her sake he would put it away. You know, otherwise he's really nice. He's really kind of a bright guy. Or she's such a nice girl. You know, and you would think that, you know, just to, you know, to be more attractive, you think she wouldn't do these things. And, you know, you hear all that stuff because people are only perceiving from their own point of view. They're not addicted to alcohol. They don't get it. These are people who are sick. We're not evil trying to get good. We're not bad, you know, bad people trying to get good or unrighteous people trying to get righteous. We're sick people trying to get well. And once you realize that alcoholism and the addiction, once it gets to a certain point, it's a disease. And the person really is not capable of making that decision. Now, every so often, some do. There's a few people that clinch. There's a story in a big book about a businessman who realized that they could have a problem with alcohol and that would interfere with his ability to make money, and money was really important to him. So he stopped drinking, made his money, and then retired, put on his bathrobe and slippers, and now he's ready to drink. In 2 years, the guy was dead. So it was an alcoholic who didn't drink, and when he did drink, he drank enough to make up for lost time and died. So that tells you something about the seriousness of this disease. Oh, I'd like to give the call a number if there's anybody out there that would like to join in the conversation, have any opinions or things they would like to say that would add to the conversation or disagree with the conversation. I'd even like that even better. If we all thought the same way, what a boring world this would be. The call-in number is 949-534-0621. That's 949-534-0621. This is Sunday night at 9 p.m. That's when we have the live show, and then we do two repeats of the show during the week, Monday nights and Saturday night. Same show, but there's no call-in. You can't. There's nobody here. I work the board, but I don't take any call-ins at the time. So this is an opportunity if you'd like to join in. Actually, I even have the ability to call someone. Did you know that? It's on the board. You can actually call somebody and say, hey, you're on the radio. I haven't done that. I don't know. Another time. I have to work up to it. I think we've been doing it for a year. Maybe by next year sometime I'll be brave enough to do that. You know, let's see, I wonder. Okay. The onion peel. This is a little different. This is about emotional addiction. I personally believe that the first thing that we're addicted to in life is our emotions. Interesting take on that. So let's get started. This is the section in the captain's table called the onion peel. These aren't original thoughts. These are validated. This is validated information. It comes from What the Bleep Do We Know? If you remember, that was real popular about 10 years ago.
Yes.
And all the information came from credible sources, both medical, psychological, and ethereal or spiritually motive, spiritually prolific, but all credible people in their fields. It started out as a double dog dare, and it's cold hard fact when you're young and dumb, the trouble with trouble is it starts out as fun. Trish Murphy. Addiction is the feeling of a chemical rush that is cascaded through the body through a whole assortment of glands and ductless glands and through the spinal fluid, what we call feelings. Some would call a sexual fantasy rage, anger, rejection, fear, loneliness, and a myriad of all emotional responses, yet there's nothing in the external world that is caught. There is no external stimuli coming from outside the body or even in the immediate environment. It only takes one thought to reignite the emotional memory with the same intensity as when it first happened. And I have a little thing. Neelix, if you remember from Star Trek, and Neelix is talking, Neelix, I feel like I'm all alone. And the doctor, who was the hologram, you are all alone. I'm only a holographic projection. The emotions produce holographic images such as rage, murder, hate, compassion, love, and so on. The brain does not know the difference what it sees in its environment and what it remembers, because it's the same specific neural net are then firing. If I only had a brain, a heart, the knife, set the Scarecrow, Tin Man, and the Lion. The brain is made up of tiny nerve cells called neurons. These neurons have tiny branches that reach out and connect to other neurons to form a neural net. Each place where they connect is incubated into a thought or memory. The brain gives us the ability to think, I think. Now, the brain builds up all its concepts by the law of associative memory. For example, ideas, thoughts, and feelings are all constructed and interconnected in the neural net and all have a possible relationship with one another. The concept and feeling of love, for instance, is stored in the vast neural net. But we build the concept of love from many other different ideas. Some people have love connected to disappointment. When they think about love, they experience the memory of pain, sorrow, anger, and even rage. Rage may be linked to a specific person, which is then connected back to love. Harold?
This is being proved out even more in more detail these days with the fantastic brain research that's going on. I'm constantly talking about it, the brain scans and all the things they're learning about the brains of infants all the way up to the elderly, the brain scans of a patient with Alzheimer's are amazing. It's just amazing to see the horrible deterioration in the brain with an Alzheimer's patient. And we're working on reversing these destructive effects. But what they're finding is that also with the electron microscopes, they are finding that they can analyze the DNA, the genes. And one of the theories about a year ago I heard is that they have identified the gene for addiction. They can see a difference. They can't fix it, but there it is. So things that we've suspected for a long time are being proved accurate and true by science now. Science is catching up, and we've known since 1935, maybe before that, but that this is a disease. People who, when they begin to drink, they cannot predict where it will end. And once we've activated that, once we've awakened that giant, he will not go back to sleep. We have to deal with that on a day-to-day basis using recovery principles. It's not just the alcohol, but also the selfishness, and it all needs to be dealt with. If it's not dealt with, and through treatment we cause it to go into remission, it will be fatal. It's just a matter of time. A person is a ticking time bomb. I met a young man last week whose drinking began at age 13. There was trauma in his life, divorce, and so forth. And so as things were, his solution to that was to drink. And he drank to get drunk from age 13 on up. He spent about 15 years drinking and then could see where things were leading and stopped. Now, I want to mention to folks who drink heavily, do not suddenly stop without being under the direct care of a doctor at the time, because seizures can occur and that can be fatal. But stopping is the first step in all this. Then the mind clears up. Then we can begin to work on some of the emotional issues that were behind our need for alcohol in the first place, or other drugs. He said he also smoked marijuana. And the whole problem is the escape from reality, not as important as how we escape, but the escape is important. So this seeing what happens in the brain is, it's fascinating, it's important, and it really is producing treatment that's more effective than ever. We used to have to guess. Now we know what works and what doesn't work. And this is an exciting time to be alive. Joseph?
Thank you, Harold. The reason we call this section the onion peel is in the program we talk about peeling back the onion. The first layer is coming, first layer of your addiction is recognizing that addiction exists. That's the first layer of the onion. And so that gets pulled back.
Yeah, this is a disease that tells you you don't have a disease.
So the first layer is you got a disease.
Yeah.
We conceded to our innermost self that we were alcoholic. Who likes to consider themselves to be bodily different than their fellows? No, that decision is not easy. It's either spiritual solution or death, incarceration, or institution. And even at that, we got to go, let's see, should I drink again or should I die? Wait a minute, let me back you on that. A splendid edifice is our mind, uniquely built one brick at a time. We build up models of how we see the world outside of us. And the more information that we have, the more we refine our model. One way or another, and what we ultimately do is tell ourselves a story about what the outside world is. Any information that we process, any information that we take in from the environment is also colored by the experiences that we've had and an emotional response that we're having to what we're bringing in a new form, and it new from the environment around us. So we keep taking this information in. Emotional memory is always about color, holographic. Emotions aren't good or bad. They just are, and they color our world. Officer, please don't give me that ticket. I've been kidnapped by emotions, and it's them that are at the wheel. Do we respond or wherever our emotions take us? Who is in the driver's seat when we control our emotions or we take the back seat and know psychologically that nerve cells that fire together wire together? If we practice something over and over, these cells have a long-term relationship. If you get angry on a daily basis, if you get frustrated on a daily basis, if you suffer on a daily basis, you give reason for the victimization in your life. You're rewiring and reintegrating the neural net on a daily basis, and that neural net now has a long-term relationship with those other nerve cells called an identity. We also know that nerve cells that don't fire together no longer wire together. They lose their long-term relationship. Every time we interrupt the thought process that produced a chemical response in the body, every time we interrupt in those nerve cells that are connected to each other, breaking the long-term relationship, when we start interrupting and observing, not by stimulus and response and automatic reaction, but by observing the effects that are manifested, then we're no longer the body-mind-conscious emotional person that's responding to its environment if we are like we're on automatic pilot. Harold?
No longer on automatic pilot. And in some circles, they're called cellular memories. A lot of this also relates to PTSD and the treatment of PTSD. And the hemispheres of the brain. So this is all very interesting work. It's very effective. And one of the approaches to help us remove these automatic responses is called EMDR, eye movement desensitization and well, it's late. I'm having a brain freeze. Restructuring. Eye movement desensitization and restructuring. And it is fascinating. They've done more research on EMDR, trying to figure out how it works, and all they've been able to manage to do is ascertain that it works. It works quickly. The effects are durable. They last. It's not expensive, and it really helps a lot of the soldiers returning from the front lines. Right now it's Afghanistan and Iraq, and returning with PTSD, and there's wonderful, wonderful results occurring with EMDR. So that relates to what we're reading and studying tonight, and very important, very, very important work. Joseph?
Thanks, Harold. Anger could be as heady as whiskey once you've gotten a taste for it. And so the way we get rid of these long-term negative emotional responses to the world is we drink. We drug. Now we're getting down to causes and conditions. So first we're addicted to our emotions. The emotionals are bringing up negative long-term relationship in our brain. This is our identity. Now when we drink, it breaks that identity. We're somebody else now. Oh, baby. Now, you know, and I've met drunks that were the nicest. I was a fun drunk. I was a fun guy when I got drunk. A little bit more quiet, sedate, reserved. But once I drank alcohol, baby, let me tell you, I'm the life of the party. You know, I could go up and talk to any girl. I could dance. There's a Hebrew saying, there's a Jewish saying that says, once you have money in your pocket, you can sing and even dance better. I was like that with alcohol. I could sing and even dance better, and I didn't sing. I could dance, though. So we're taking alcohol. Pfizer, Johnson & Johnson, and Roche, not even close. The most sophisticated pharmacy in the universe. You know where that is, Harold?
The human brain.
Yeah, right here. Right between your ears is part of the brain called the hypothalamus, and the hypothalamus is like a mini factory. It is a place that assembles certain chemicals that matches certain emotions that we experience, and these particular chemicals are called peptides. They're a small chain amino acid sequences. So every emotional response has its own peptide. Wow, what do you know that? It's a perfect match. The body is basically a carbon-based entity that makes about 20 different amino acids altogether in order to formulate its physical structure. The body is a protein-producing machine. In the hypothalamus, we take small-chain proteins called peptides, and we assemble them into certain neuropeptides or neurohormones that match the emotional state that we experience on a daily basis. So there's chemicals for anger, and there are chemicals for sadness, and there are chemicals for victimization. There are chemicals for lust. There's a chemical that matches every emotional state that we experience. And in the moment that we experience that emotional state in our body, or more precisely in our brain, the hypothalamus will immediately assemble the associated peptide and then release it through the pituitary and into the bloodstream. The moment it makes its way into the bloodstream and finds its way to different centers or different parts of the body. Wow. I don't know if it's done. This was real interesting stuff to me. I had no idea this stuff was going on. A successful cell has 1,000 fathers and an emotional ringtone. Every single cell in the body has receptors on the surface of the cell. One cell could have thousands of receptors studying its surface. A receptor is a kind of opening to the outside world. And when a peptide docks on a cell, it literally is like a key going into a lock. It sits on the receptor surface and attaches to it and physically moves the receptor. And like a doorbell buzzing, it sends a signal into the brain. Then I have something from the Beatles. Yesterday, oh, my troubles seemed so far away. Now it looks like they're here to stay. Oh, I believe in yesterday. What happened in the adulthood is most of us who've had our glitches along the way are operating in an emotionally detached place, or we are operating as if today were yesterday. We are either living in an emotionally disconnected place or in an overly emotional reactive place because they've gone to an earlier time in reality. When this happens, the person is not operating as an integrated whole. Harold?
We had an interesting case at the clinic. One of our team leader was telling us about his experience. He was age 90 and coming in, talking about an experience he had with his dad, where his dad called him lazy and worthless. And this was when he was 14. And somehow, some of these experiences have such a powerful effect on us that they live on. As this man, who, of course, didn't really believe there was any value in counseling at all, but as he talked about that experience, it was as if it happened yesterday, and it just goes to prove that some experiences, for various reasons, have such an emotional charge that they have a timeless quality to them, and what can happen in an effective counseling session is that emotional charge can be disconnected, the energy can be metabolized, basically, and the person can be free from that time warp, that trap, and their life can take on new meaning and purpose. So that was just that was to improve his relationships in general. Many people come in because actually what's the main thing that's bothering them is an addiction to either alcohol or drugs, and the same processes can be effective there too. So it's an exciting time. So if you find yourself with intrusive thoughts or experiences from the ancient past that seem like they were yesterday, it might be a good idea to seek outside help, as it says in the big book, and see someone, because it's very freeing to work on this on the situation from every possible angle. That's what it's all about. Joseph?
Thank you, Harold. I think it's really about breaking that long-term relationship. He's got a long-term relationship in his neural net. It's locked in, baby. It's been there so long, he doesn't know how to break it. Can't figure out, but he keeps replaying. He's living in that past. and he's got that long-term relationship in his brain, and he's stuck until he can do something about it. And the best he could do was to go to a therapist so the therapist could start breaking that long-term relationship. But it's been there an awful long time, so he's got to want to do it, and it's going to take a lot of work. He doesn't get it yet. He might have a – that's what we call, I think, when you break the neural net like that for a negative, we've had a breakthrough. Isn't that the term? We have a breakthrough in recovery. We've been able to break through that neural net.
A catharsis.
Mr. Starbucks. Pardon me?
A catharsis. A breakthrough, yeah. And see, he wasn't even thinking about it. He didn't even realize it was there. It had been a long time since the thought had even entered his mind. But it's there in the brain, and it can be cured.
Mr. Starbuck, we have played the scene a billion receptors before the ocean rolled. Along the outside of the cell are these billions of receptor sites. They are just receivers of incoming information. A receptor that has a peptide sitting in it changes the cell in many ways. It sets up a whole cascade of biochemical events, some of which wind up with changes in the actual nucleus of the cell. It's alive with a library card and a new pair of glasses. Each cell is definitely alive, and each cell has a consciousness. Wow. Particularly if we define consciousness as the point of view of an observer. There is always the perspective of the cell. In fact, the cell is the smallest unit of consciousness in the body. I'm not addicted. I just can't stop at any time. I can stop at any time, just not today. My definition of an addiction is something really simple, something you can't stop, even at a red light. I used to live in hell. It was familiar. I knew where all the light switches were. Familiar things, even when painful, it gives the feeling of being right at home. We bring to ourselves situations that we fulfill the biochemical craving of the cells of anybody by creating situations that meet our chemical needs. We think our troubles of our own making, right from the big book. We dig a ditch and fall therein. We roll a stone and it rolls back upon us. And the addict will always need a little bit more in order to get a rush or a high of what they're looking for chemically. My definition really means that if you can't control your emotional state, you must be addicted to it. Mr. Spock, how is it not to have any emotions? This is not a good time for me, Captain. I need to be held and have a good cry. We are emotions, and emotions are us. We can't separate from our emotions. When you consider that every aspect of your digestion, every sphincter that opens and closes, every group of cells that come in for nourishment and then move out to heal something or repair something, those are all under the influence of the molecules of emotion. It's this total buzz. Green with envy, red with rage, melancholy through and through, always looks best in the color blue. Does that mean emotions are good or emotions are bad? No, emotions are what color the richness of our experience. The experience of our world and of our lives. Emotions are designed so that it reinforces chemically something into long-term memory. That's why we have them. If you think you're addicted, that's your problem. If you actually know you're addicted, that's your second problem. Harold?
Well, yes, and the interesting thing about the neuroreceptors and the peptides that go in as keys in a lock is that, as I did, for example, taking cocaine stimulates those, all those chemicals, and the receptors get bombarded with the feel-good chemicals to the extent that they, after a few hours or a couple of days, they begin to say, hey, wait a minute, we can't handle this, we're going to shut down. And so they do. And as some of the receptors shut down, their neighboring receptors also, then they get bombarded, they also shut down, and pretty soon, that's basically what we have when we say brain damage. And if we stop bombarding the brain with the chemicals, those receptors will switch on again, but it takes a while. Especially with too many pain pills, it could take 12 to 18 months for them to switch back on again. In the meantime, the person... Well, and yes, they'll switch on, but it takes time. And while people are waiting, they say, many people have said to me, well, I stopped, and I still don't feel good. So they're waiting for normal reactions to return. They take a nice walk on a sunny day or play with their dog or play with a child, and it feels kind of blah. This is called post-acute withdrawal syndrome, and it's something that some of the treatment centers don't talk much about. Basically, it means things are going to get worse before they get better, because the person will leave their drug and they will feel very under a lot of distress when they're without their drug. And then things will begin to return to normal, but it takes time, and they weren't prepared for that. So people should be warned in early recovery. This is not going to be instantly better. This will take some time, especially folks that were addicted to opioids, the pain medications. So that's part of what we're talking about this program, is the changes to the brain. And let me mention real quickly another thing that really changes the brain, exactly like cocaine. Now that they know from looking at brain scans, it's viewing porn. The receptor sites shut down in just the same way as they do with cocaine, and it requires a period of total abstinence for the brain to begin to repair itself there too, which is quite shocking and unexpected to the porn addict. Many people, when they're addicted to alcohol or cocaine, when they stop those chemicals, they will switch to porn. And it's just as serious and does just as much brain damage as drugs. So look out, folks. Joseph?
Hi, Carol. It's our addiction that's the problem. The thing most people realize is that when they understand that they are addicted to emotions, it's not just psychological, it's not just spiritual, it's also biochemical. Think about this. Heroin uses the same receptor mechanisms on the cells that our emotional chemicals use. Whoa. It's easy to see then that if we can be addicted to heroin, then we can be addicted to any neural peptide, any emotion. We begin by coveting what we see every day. Don't you feel eyes moving over your body, Clarice? And don't your eyes seek out the things you want? Hannibal Lecter. Remember Hannibal?
Oh yeah.
That was one of his quotes. The relevant search command that's going on is related to finding a certain emotional state. I mean, we can't even direct our eyes without having an emotional aspect to it. Now, what about people who are addicted to sex? Remember this? Remember this? Whoa, you like to think you're immune to the stuff. Oh, yeah. It's closer to the truth to say you can't get enough. You know, you're going to have to face it. You're addicted to love. Remember that, Huey Robert
Lewis.
Palmer?
Dude, huh?
Robert Palmer. The AA 12 and 12 say, to think of liking lust seems impossible, but how many men and women speak love with their lips and believe what they say so they can hide lust in a dark corner of their mind? And even while staying within conventional bounds, many people have to admit that their imaginary sex excursions are apt to be all dressed up as dreams of romance. That's in the 12 and 12, step 6. Sex was my drug of choice. That's when I still had a choice. Sex is like a drug in that releases naturally occurring peptides, such as endorphins, which correspond to specific receptors in the cell, as well as the pleasure centers of the brain. Dr. Patrick Carnes writes in his book, Don't Call It Love, Recovery from Sexual Addiction. These peptides parallel the molecular structure of opiates, like morphine, but they are many times more powerful. We know that when experimental rats are habituated to morphine or heroin, they will go through much pain in order to obtain more. However, when the pleasure centers of the brain are stimulated, releasing endorphins, rats will go through even more suffering than they do for the morphine or heroin. I think so, I am what I am, and that's it. Our mind literally creates our body, and it all starts in the cell. The cell is a protein-producing machine, but it gets a signal from the brain. Please be careful with me. I'm sensitive, and I'd like to stay that way. One of the things about receptors, they change in their sensitivity. If any given receptor has a given drug or peptide is being bombarded for a long time at a high intensity, it will literally shrink up, and there will be less of them, or it will be hooked up in such a way that it is desensitized or downregulated. So the same amount of drug, peptide, will elicit a much smaller response. If we are bombarding the cell with the same attitude and the same chemistry over and over on a daily basis, when that cell finally decides to divide, when it produces a sister cell or a daughter cell, the next cell will have more receptor sites for those particular emotional neuropeptides and less receptor sites for vitamins, minerals, nutrients, fluid exchange, or even the release of waste products or toxins. You know you're getting old when everything hurts. What doesn't hurt doesn't work. Disease runs like a river in a stream until they dump into the old age sea. All aging is the result of improper protein production. What happens when we age? Our skin loses elasticity. Elastin is a protein. What happens to our enzymes? We don't digest well. What happens to our synovial fluid? Those are proteins that become brittle and stiff. What happens to our bones? They become thin. So we can conclude that all aging is a result of improper protein production. Harold?
And the interesting thing about this process, the scientists are actually saying is that as the receptor cells shut down and as these connections are formed and then overused, what it means physically for the sex addict is that it requires more and more stimulation to achieve the same effect, and a lot of the if there are kids listening, you can cover their ears. A lot of what porn addiction is about is the masturbation that accompanies it, and what the addict experiences is that they have to be rougher and rougher and rougher. The stimulation has to increase more and more to achieve the effect that they want. And it can be quite physically destructive. The other thing that's destroyed is their relationship with their spouse, because now normal sexual contact is not nearly rough enough or stimulating enough to help this individual achieve any kind of orgasm. And so it drives a wedge between a husband and wife, and that's the main effect. The wife wonders if there's another woman, or if he's getting sex somewhere else. Well, it's actually self-stimulation that's become so rough that it really interferes with the sex in the marriage. So that's what we're dealing with. That's part of the problem, switching addictions. Joseph?
Thank you, Harold. Yeah, pornography, my understanding, I have that on the site, it's one of the TED Talks, is that the difference with the pornography than drugs and alcohol, with drugs and alcohol, it's always more of the same. With pornography, it's more different. Higher and higher degrees of, I don't know,
shock
inappropriate
value.
Or rougher. Yeah, the more, from what I understand, that the degrees keep going up. You might start with messenger sex, like copulation, then it goes into more fellatio, and it gets rougher, group sex, and, you know, just like it just keeps rising up the scale, higher and higher impacts of stimulation. And, of course, like any other emotional addiction, you get less and less reaction with more and more stimulation. So it's really debilitating. I've known a few fellas in the program that got sucked into it. They're not interested in women. You know, they lock the door, and they spend literally fortunes on the Internet cruising this stuff. And they lose all aspect of a normal intimate relationship with a woman. They're gone. And it's a lot of work to get out of that. It's very powerful. Make no mistake, you could actually feel it crawling out of the Internet. Very powerful, very destructive, something to really watch. And it's a secondary addiction for most, and some of the primary addiction. And then back it goes back and forth. You're off alcohol, get into pornography. Are we what we eat, or what's eating us? Then the question arises, does it really matter what we eat? And does nutrition really have an effect if the cell doesn't even have the receptor sites after 20 years of emotional abuse to even receive or let alone let in the nutrients that are necessary for its health? So emotional addiction causes aging. Wow, that was really quite a surprise for me. So the question of all this, are spiritual beings having a physical experience? Then we are gods in the making, and you have to walk this path. But someday you have to love the spirit as much as you've loved the condition of addiction. The only way that we will ever be great to myself is not what I do to my body, but I do with my mind and my spirit. Harold, any last words?
That's really the key to this. The whole problem is that addiction is a search for God at the wrong address, and many of us didn't realize we were searching for God, but that's the important thing. And by working a program, adopting a new way of life, we can get back to God, reconcile that relationship, and everything else in life improves. It's all about total abstinence and working a program to clean our lives up, and doing that by depending on God, not trying to just do it humanly. Joseph?
Thank you, Harold. A little interesting highlight, I was on Facebook today, I was telling you about it, and had a really good conversation going, a lot of good information, and finished, you know, that it kind of petered out, the guy got his information, and when I went back on to see if there was any further comments, they had pulled the whole thread off. And I believe the reason why is they would say that this is big book thumpers, and anything outside of the big book is not welcomed on the site, no matter how relevant, no matter how true, no matter how helpful, it doesn't belong there. Because I think it's about Rum Radio, but what do I know? But it's funny how people will try to stop other people from gaining information. Isn't that amazing? That always amazes me.
That is amazing.
You know, they, you know, like, come on, guy, what, you playing God? What's that? It's nobody was ever been made pregnant by a book or raped by a movie. This is just information. Let people look at it, make their own decision. But you know, that's not the way life works. At a higher level, it does, sure, but not in real life. It's people like to control. What I've learned is, any time any man has the presumption of authority, that he will ultimately exercise unrighteous dominion and the illusion of control. Rum Radio is now in 147 foreign countries, including Mississippi, 2,600 plus towns, cities, and villages. And we've just went 196,000 hits to the website since September 10th, 2009. So we're a little over 3 years, 3 years, 3 months into the process. This is a good work from all over the world. No money is being made, like Harold said. And we're anonymous to the 11th tradition of Alcoholics Anonymous. Is that I don't use my last name. I can't get away with it on Facebook. It was too late for that. But on the website, it's just Joseph, and I believe that gives the principle. We do promote the site, just like GSO now is promoting AA and Press Radio and Films, and I believe that's okay. Is we can do anything that doesn't interfere with our primary purpose. As a matter of fact, this enhances our primary purpose, I believe. So take a look. It's rumradio.org, and you're welcome to any information on the website. Thank you, and good night, Harold, and good night. Audience. And good night, Mrs. Calabash, wherever you are. Good night.
Good night.